From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
When I saw news of an upcoming webinar about invasive plants listed on the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society's website, I knew I wanted to sign up and listen in, and also that I wanted to talk to the presenter who founded a business in 2016 to help private and public landowners with the remediation of Japanese knotweed, multiflora rose, oriental bittersweet, and other thugs that are crowding out native plants and destroying wildlife habitat. Invasives are our topic today, so more in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
Today's guest is Christian Allen, who founded Invasive Plant Solutions in 2016 when he was still pursuing a double major in horticulture and economics at the University of Connecticut. Rather than just watch the continuing ravaging of natural habitats by invasive species in Connecticut and Massachusetts, where he practices, he decided to do something to make it his career path. "This does not have to be our reality," he says. "We can choose to restore nature." So welcome, Christian, with that in mind. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay. Winter.
Yes.
Yeah. I think we could all use a dose of your optimism and your determination and some of your how-to insights about dealing with invasives. And before we start, I want to say, for your online lecture for Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, it's February 22nd at 5:30 Eastern, with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. I'm going to give away a couple of tickets for people to attend, and I know I'm going to be attending. So just as a FYI. So tell us just quickly about sort of, you know, how did you get into this and, you know, your background and what you do?
Yeah, certainly. So it was a lifelong interest, and it started on Easter Sunday, 1997. That was the firm start when I was all dolled up as a little Sunday school kind of kid looking off my parents' porch in East Canaan. They built a house in an abandoned horse pasture, and the hedgerows were just atrocious, filled with invasives. And on my father's side, I am an old Yankee, and my grandfather, Paul Allen, who was a former first selectman here in North Canaan, often described playing with his friends in the woods, and same with my father. And I never had that opportunity. And looking right into the hedgerows and into the woods and seeing the tangle of multiflora rose and bittersweet, I said to myself, this isn't right. I got to do something about this. So that evolved in 2011, working with our locally famous Tom Zetterstrom in the Arboretum and Landscape Committee at the Housatonic Valley Regional High School here in Falls Village. Planning and executing the removal of invasives from the north campus of the high school, which has been an ongoing process. But that served as the beginning of what could be built into a business.
Right. And so when you say, just for people who are elsewhere, you say East Canaan and Falls Village, we're talking about Connecticut, the northwest part of Connecticut. But a lot of the plants we're going to talk about today, sadly, are wide ranging over large swaths of the country, not just here.
Certainly.
Yeah. So quickly, kind of what's an invasive from your point of view as someone who works to remediate, subdue, destroy, get rid of them? What's an invasive?
So invasive plants are actually defined by federal law. In 1996, President Clinton put an executive order defining an invasive plant as a not just a noxious weed, but a noxious weed that is foreign to the North American continent and has the capability of reproducing and causing major economic or human health harm. And part of that executive order, he established the ability for states to create invasive plant councils. So here in Connecticut, we have a Connecticut Invasive Plant Council made up of scientists, professors, members of our Ag Extension Service, DEEP, and other professionals in the field that catalog different plant species and rule whether or not they are indeed an invasive plant. In Connecticut, we have approximately 84 invasive plants. The list continues to grow as we discover additional species that fit that definition. There are aquatic invasive plants, there are terrestrial invasive plants, and my business particularly focuses on those terrestrial invasive plants.
And so something can be a quote weed without being categorized officially as an invasive plant. But do invasives, or do the plants that you tackle, do they have sort of common characteristics that maybe inform you about managing them? Is there something, or do you look like when you go to sort of decide what the approach is, you know, are there characteristics I'm a longtime gardener, so, you know, I'm weeding all the time for decades, you know, and I know the things that are rhizomatous are going to give me a harder time than certain other root systems and so on and so forth. So do you kind of look for different characteristics?
Yes. So since 1996, when that executive order was passed, there's been studies executed by our land grant universities, including UConn, our Ag Extension Services, not just in Connecticut, but all across the country, as to the best management practices for each invasive plant, and especially whether or not you need to use herbicides or not. So what I did beginning at my time at UConn was analyze the studies and fact sheets constructed by those services and decide, okay, this is what, you know, Pennsylvania Ag Extension is the best management practice. This is what the University of Connecticut says is the best management practice. And more often than not, those best management practices align. And that type of system, it becomes very easy to execute once you understand that mode of action. So some invasive plants like multiflora rose, bittersweet, honeysuckle, once they're in that hedgerow type of environment, a very similar management strategy can be undertaken. But if they're on their own, a different management strategy would be undertaken.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And there are others that are invasive plants that are much more extreme, like Japanese knotweed, which we could get into.
Yeah, we will. And so you kind of just hinted at the elephant in the living room with sort of any conversation about invasives is whether or not they can realistically be sort of subdued / eradicated without chemicals. And I have to say, even though I'm a longtime organic gardener, when I see the destruction of habitat that's happening or has happened, you know, along the roadsides everywhere, the literal changing landscape, you know, changed landscape, the lack of a forest floor, of a herbaceous layer, you know, I mean, so much destruction. You know, I start to wonder if saying no to chemicals 100% of the time is always feasible. And even conservation organizations trying to reclaim important habitat and preserve land use them in the least toxic way possible for the greater good, and to bring that land back to life and diversity, right? So, so maybe just maybe you could kind of explain the approach, because you're not out there all day long spraying 100,000 or 1,000-foot long hedgerows with gallons of herbicide. That's not the tactic. It's a
And it is the tactic occasionally. So the situation is we're at a point where our land is corrupted by these invasive plants to the point where there is next to no habitat for our native plants, and in turn our native animals. So what we have to do is remove the invasives at the right season, time of the year, and winter is a prime time for it, actually, for the actual removal of the hedgerows in particular. And then thereafter, only use the herbicide when necessary. So some invasive plants like purple loosestrife, there was a biological control insect that was released in 2012 to specifically target purple loosestrife. So generally, when I'm looking at a property and there's a purple loosestrife problem, I generally do not advise chemical treatment.
Right.
However, with the hedgerow type of environment with bittersweet, multiflora rose, honeysuckle, there are two different herbicides that provide the best management and least environmental impact. And they are both glyphosate and triclopyr products. Mm-hmm. So glyphosate and triclopyr are the active ingredients. And glyphosate, as you may know, is kind of the main concern in the herbicide world right now.
Right.
Because of it's the active ingredient in Roundup.
Right.
So the key difference there is that glyphosate is the active ingredient, but the brand name Roundup or any herbicide brand name by law does not have to disclose to the consumer what surfactants or any other additive is in the herbicide that creates the result that it gives. So I only use Rodeo herbicide, which is a Dow AgroScience, now Corteva AgroScience product, which is wetlands approved and generally recommended by all of our extension services across the country for invasive management.
Right. So you really drill in to get to the right solution with the least impact, sort of the spirit of integrated pest management, even though these are plant pests rather than insect pests. I mean, to do the least harm while doing the greatest good.
Exactly.
Each action.
Truly a prescription for the land.
Right. So you've mentioned hedgerows a few times. And so let's just visualize, let's paint a visual picture. So I'm driving along the road, even where I live, and it's just changed in the last two decades, especially. You mentioned multiflora rose and honeysuckles and bittersweet and, you know, the privet, the miles of privet, barberry. So a hedgerow is what it sounds like. It's like a thicket, sort of, so to speak, of woody plants that have sort of tangled together. Is that what you mean by hedgerow?
Well, there's our native hedgerows, and then there's our corrupted invasive hedgerows. So
okay.
I guess the two examples for our area in Northwest Connecticut that you could use is if you were to drive in Route 41 in Sharon or Route 22 in New York State, and you would look off into the farm fields and you would see these swirling masses of plants, just chaos. That is multiflora rose, honeysuckle, bittersweet, and other invasive plants all tangling around our native cherry trees, our dogwoods, our ash trees, which are all in the process of dying right now, as I'm sure you know and your listeners know.
Right, sure. But
if you take a drive even north into Franklin County, Massachusetts, into Monroe, into Florida, you will see our native hedgerows, which have beautiful sugar maples and cherries and dogwoods that are uncorrupted, that are clean, well-formed. And that's what our area looked like not even 50 years ago.
Correct.
And we can get it back to that scene using the right strategy and with limited use of herbicide.
And does that start with at some particular time of year when we're talking about a woody, these are woody things? Does that mean first cutting them down? What happens?
Have to remove what I call the biomass. It's an invasive plant biomass because it's different species all tangled into one. So in that extreme invasive plant pressure environment, the best thing to do is to either brush hog or forestry mow the entire hedgerow. In that process, you will uncover the trees that were casualties of the invasive plants that should also either be removed or left as snag trees for
wildlife. Sure.
Exactly. So that process should be executed in the winter, roughly beginning in November and ending in mud season, March or April.
So we're cleansing the palate in winter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Burning off the dead wood without fire.
Right. Okay.
So the hedgerow is now clear. And in that process, sometimes you'll find red twig dogwood and gray dogwood and viburnum that are in those hedgerows that you could either avoid cutting down or unfortunately are within the path that they must be cut down.
Right.
But regardless of whether they're cut down if they are cut down. They will resprout. So all of our native and invasive plants in that hedgerow environment will resprout in spring. So what a contractor like myself can do is take a ride along the hedgerow and spot spray treat each invasive plant and avoid each native plant.
Spot spray, we're not talking about, again, broadcasting like huge spray of, we're talking about like really targeting onto the cut, onto the stump or whatever's left. Is that, or well, the beginning of new growth?
The stump will resprout into clumps of new growth, and that new growth in one season will be approximately 6 inches to a foot high.
Okay.
So we're spray painting or spraying little basketball sized resprouting invasive plants, thus limiting the amount of herbicide we're using.
Right. Okay. Okay. So, and a lot of those plants that you just talked about, I mean, like multiflora rose, you're talking about Connecticut, and I live adjacent to where you're talking about, but I mean, multiflora rose, if you look at the range maps, I love the, I forget the name of the website, the University of Georgia has a website that shows the range maps of invasive species around the country. And I mean, if you look at the range map for multiflora rose, I mean, it's in most of the United States. You know, Japanese knotweed, maybe 2/3 or 3/4 of the country, except some of the sort of arid zone western states, I think. And, you know, these are plants that have proven that they are not going to behave anywhere, really.
Certainly. This type of hedgerow corruption exists as far west as Minnesota, into Canada, and definitely south into the deep south of the United States. And a different form of it exists in Europe. There are North American plants that are invasive in Europe and are causing very similar problems.
Right. So speaking of Japanese knotweed, you know, to me visually, it's been perhaps the most dramatic invasion I've seen in the last decade or two where we live, only because of its stature. And it actually has a kind of showy appearance, you know, from you're driving by and there's this big stand of it and it catches your eye. It's not indistinct by any means. But this is it's a herbaceous plant, but its root system is, formidable. So how do you figure out what to do with a beast like that?
Well, it's named knotweed for a reason. And, and the reason why knotweed is such an issue is exactly the root system. So in any plant, turgor pressure is the amount of water pressure a vascular system can take in and exert onto the soil or hardscape around it. And Japanese knotweed is a clonal propagator. So anytime there's a flooding event or someone simply just digs it up and puts it somewhere else, this knotweed will grow. Its roots will knot right up into our hardscape features, our stone walls, our foundations, our water lines, our power conduit, and destroy them. And that's why it's such an extreme concern. I've been in buildings here in Northwest Connecticut, actually across Connecticut, that have had knotweed growing through their foundations, that have had knotweed actually even growing through a building. I have a picture of a knotweed plant growing on the inside of a shed in Lakeville, Connecticut. So it's an extreme plant, and it is very herbicide resistant if you use the wrong formulation of herbicide. Mm-hmm. The only way to remove knotweed is either using a glyphosate product or an imazapyr product. Those are two different active ingredients. And imazapyr, I generally do not recommend because it translocates.
Right.
Glyphosate, according to our federal government, does not translocate. So in a knotweed situation, you really have to use that herbicide in order to gain effective control at the right time of the year.
So do you wait till it's like close to flowering and cut it down first and then paint this what's left, or what's the timing here?
There's three options. One is you could cut down the plants in June. By June, the knotweed stalks, they grow like asparagus in May. And then by June, they'll be about 3 feet high. You could cut them down in May. If you're not near a water body, or transportation of the stalks is not likely, because if one of those stalks up to 1/4 inch in length gets anywhere else, it will create a new knotweed infestation. So then by August or September, after flowering, the plant will be 3 feet high, and then you could spray treat it with glyphosate. If it is in a sensitive site, you could either not cut it and spray it when it's at the 6-foot height which is generally what I recommend because you get the maximum intake of herbicide to really begin the dieback of the root system, which is necessary in order to maintain control. Or if it's a very small infestation, you could actually inject the stems with glyphosate concentrate. Only 5 milliliters per stem will kill each stem. I've been at sites here across Connecticut where there's maybe 15 or 25 stalks of knotweed in a very small infestation. And after injection in the second year, there's next to no knotweed left.
Right. And that's a minuscule, it's not chemicals, but it, compared to spraying a massive infestation in full, in its full glory up above ground. I mean, that would use a lot less, I would imagine, chemical.
Well, it's interesting. Once you dilute the rodeo to the proper, or glyphosate to the proper levels, you're using very limited actual concentrate.
I see.
So when you're injecting, if you're injecting a small site, you will be using more chemical than you would if you were spot spraying. But it is a very targeted control, and it's very unlikely
that
you will get any herbicide in a place that it does not belong.
I see.
Unfortunately, though, with knotweed, we have infestations across the United States that are enormous. If you look at the Connecticut River and the Deerfield River up in Massachusetts, or the Delaware River, or any of our interstates and state highways, our larger state highways like Route 8 in Waterbury and Route 2 in Glastonbury, it is a knotweed clone.
Yeah.
And that's going to require some intense maintenance.
Yeah. So we have maybe 3-4 minutes left, and I just want to ask about my particular obsession, which is Oriental bittersweet, a vine, a woody vine, and the birds love to gather the fruits and then poop out the seeds all over the place. And I feel like what I do most of my gardening season is pull up bittersweet seedlings. Is there any hope for bittersweet? And what would be the, you know, is that one where we should cut down the big woody vines to the ground, paint the stump with a chemical? And I mean, what about
right,
that?
So that's the best case scenario, is if you have a single or a forest stand where you could obviously see each bittersweet vine,
right.
You could cut them, treat them with rodeo concentrate and a device known as a buckthorn blaster, which is just a modified bingo dauber with glyphosate and blue dye in it. And I could send you the link to that product. That is the best case scenario. In those hedgerow type environments, it's best to clear the bittersweet out and then either spot spray or treat the stump if you could find it. But the key thing with bittersweet is it has a seed latency period, meaning that the seeds are alive in the soil for up to 20 years. So you have to keep an eye out for those seedlings every year, or else you could have the infestation grow right back. Other invasive plants have less seed or lower seed latency periods.
Yeah, the seed bank on that one is like, whoa, it's unbelievable. And which I think is part of its big success, obviously, is that it has that going for it. So you're going to do this this talk for Pennsylvania Horticultural Society February 22, I think it is.
That's
in the
right.
afternoon. And what do you think the most popular plants that people, because there's going to be a gardening audience, we're going to ask you about? What do you think they're going to be asking you about? Like English ivy or?
Well, certainly bittersweet.
Yeah.
Some of the other shrub invasives like honeysuckle or barberry will come in. And barberry attracts ticks, so that's another concern for people.
Yeah.
But I think the two heavy hitters will be, of course, Japanese knotweed, but also goutweed.
Right, of course, yes.
And Agapodium requires chemical treatment, but it can be effectively either dug out if you are very
diligent.
Very diligent about it and targeted, and also use the herbicides in tandem. But it takes years of follow-up in order to effectively gain control.
Yeah. Rinse and repeat. You know, it's a lot of do-overs, right?
90%, 95%, 99%. And then you're at that 99.9% until it's truly gone.
Well, Christian Allen of Invasive Plant Solutions, and with the transcript of the show on awaytogarden.com. As I said, I'm going to give links to your website. I'm going to give information about your talk, your virtual talk that people can attend, webinar, and other work that you're doing, and then some of the other links we talked about. So thank you so much for making time today. And I guess you're going out to mow down a brush hog down a couple hedgerows, right?
Well, actually, what I do is I have forestry mowing contractors. So if there's any forestry mowing contractor listening, I'm happy to work with them.
Yeah, I
they
bet.
They do that, and I do what I'm good at. So
okay.
Sharing is caring.
Okay. Well, thank you, Christian. I'll talk to you again soon, I hope.
Looking forward to it.
Underwriting support from Timber Press, the leading publisher in books that share wonders with the natural world, including A Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. The stunning guide imparts decades of plant wisdom and challenges readers to think beyond their garden borders and to consider the ways gardening can enrich the world. Available everywhere books are sold and at timberpress.com. They invite you to come grow with them.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher, and you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.